From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia with ease, travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk, and take away the guesswork that goes along with converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
I look back and I'm like, if I hadn't found stand-up comedy, I would be dead by now. I just really honestly believe that. The fact that I found my way out of it is a story of such rich absurdity that it almost doesn't ring true.
Hello and welcome to The Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. This is an exciting episode, a redo, but it's with one of my favorite artists. The first episode we taped was obliterated by two recording failures, one in the main recording and then a secondary one in the backup recording. And luckily, we were able to do it again. And I will tell you, as good as the first one was, the second one was even better. So I'm glad this is one we get to release. Hannah Gadsby is an Australian comedian. She was behind the remarkable Netflix special, Nanette. She just recently brought out a new one called Douglas. Nanette's a piece of art that actually means a lot to me. It's one of those pieces of art where people tell you, you engage with things and you can maybe get a little glimpse of what it is like to live as someone else in the world. And Nanette did that for me. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And it's also just like its structure. Like, I remember my jaw just dropping as it unfurled towards the end. Her most recent special is Douglas, which is about the way she thinks. Hannah Gadsby received a diagnosis of autism a couple of years back, and that has contextualized parts of her life for her. So we talk about those issues, autism, the issues she brought up in Nanette around speech and safety and going through the world as somebody whom the world does not make much space for. This is a very honest conversation where most of what I knew about her came from her shows and getting this much deeper sense of her life. And how brutal some of the periods that she has turned into comedy or turned into stories were, and just what it is like to be in the world as an autistic person with her tendencies and predilections and needs and hopes and desires. I found this to be a really moving conversation. I hope you will too. As always, my email is EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here is Hannah Gadsby. Hannah Gadsby, welcome back to the show. Although for viewers, it's the first time on the show.
Yes. Yes, the other one was an invisible participation. It disappeared into the ether.
But it is so good. There's a Wilco song I love called The Late Greats about how the best song has never been heard. Like, it's like this one show nobody went to with a singer nobody has been around to listen to. And it's like that. It's like the perfect show that has been out there hanging out in the mists of legend.
Well, there was a time when that was the only form of communication. We've only very recently started to capture our communication and to make it permanent. And I think that's half the reason we're in this mess, you know, because once it's permanent, there's less chance for people to apologize and reshape their thinking because they're getting held to ideas they've had previously, and then they double down on it and become assholes.
I think it's actually really right. I whenever I read old history books, I'm struck by how beautiful everyone is at crafting themselves in letters. And I think about how today it's what you say. On the one hand, we're going to have like video evidence of every dumb thing we've ever said. But also the only way you'll hear what we thought about it is they're going to like pull text messages out of our phones when we're dead and we're all going to sound like defensive idiots.
Which we are. So it's going to be a more honest future. So I think often you look back into history and you go, my word, we used to be eloquent. We used to have manners. No, we didn't. We just didn't leave proof of the otherwise.
Do you think it was better when we wrote letters? Do you miss letter writing?
No, my whole life has been filled. I still feel guilt from letters I didn't write when I should have written them. When I was a kid, I used to play golf. I played representative golf, of all things, in Tasmania. Anyway, it's a very long and possibly an interesting story. I can't judge. But anyway, so I'd be selected to play in the state team. And for that pleasure, I had to then thank the committee that selected me. And then when I'd go and play in, you know, Australian juniors, then after it finished, I had to write a thank you letter to everyone involved in that. And I never got round to writing those letters. And I look back in hindsight, and I was racked with guilt for years, because I knew I should write those letters. I understood that it was manners. But then also most of me was aware that my brother, who was also playing golf, didn't have to write those letters. And so the hypocrisy really, really annoyed me. And then also writing letters is, you know, you sit down and write a letter and it's just like, you know what people want to hear. And therefore it just sounds, you know, like a thank you note to the selection committee. I used to sit there and like, well, I know what they want me to hear from me. So why don't they just pretend I wrote it? Because I'm just going to write what they want to hear. And there's no sincerity to it at all. My whole life I've had a complete aversion to stupid exercises like that. Like, you understand what people want, so you do what they want. And then it just doesn't feel like there's any personal growth. So I never wrote the letters, but I felt the guilt around not writing the letters.
Who enforced the differential thank you note regime? Was it that the women's team had to do it? Or was it your mom made you write letters and didn't make your brother write letters, or wanted to make you write letters and didn't want to make your brother write letters?
No, it was sort of like the done thing on the girls team. So basically, you played golf as a young woman to prepare you to be a wife, whereas boys could play golf because they play golf. So when I'd win a trophy, I'd win a casserole dish or something like that. I've still under my parents' home. Got all these. Yeah, I've got my dowry. I was collecting a dowry. I've got lace tablecloths. I've got a clock cut out of a hewn pine in the shape of Tasmania. That never needs to be used, although it's a tidy bit of wood. So, you know, I was basically, every competition I won encouraged me to, you know, put together a dowry. A blender, I won a blender once, whereas my brother would win things like golf balls and things that encouraged him to play more golf.
Is there a lot more golf involved in Tasmanian marriages? Like, where did this association come from?
No, it's just the idea of like what girls should do, and it bled into the social infrastructure of golf. And golf is awful on every level as far as sexism and racism and elitism is concerned. I think it's so funny that I used to play it, because it really is everything that is wrong with the world.
What were you like as a kid?
I was very slow moving. I was very quiet. I was wry, I think. People tell me I had a good sense of humor. I liked routine. I was watching the world for the most part. I didn't participate in life until very recently.
Except for the golf.
Well, golf is like, sport was a really good thing for me because you knew what to do. So it's just sort of like, because I used to play hockey. I was from this is fun. I was from the sort of town where if you didn't play a sport, then you got into trouble. If you're a boy, you did drugs. If you're a girl, you got pregnant. Really, honestly, girls did both. We can do it all. but, you know, it was a rough end of the world. It was a tough place to live. The town was dependent on industries, and industries don't always look after the population. So, you know, it's a bleakness to it. And so my mum was very adamant that we played sport. And so I as a young kid, I played hockey, and I was in goals because I didn't fare so well in the team sport part of it because there's so many variables. Whereas in goals, you know, the scope of what you have to do and what happens is much more limited. So I was a natural goalie and I was quite good at it. But then I had an accident. My life is punctuated by accidents. I had a lot of accidents. And this was one of the first big ones. I tore my anterior cruciate ligament. I just fell off my bike weird one weekend and had to have a total knee reconstruction. And I was 11 years old. And that's not an easy Oof. Reconstruction to have when you're still growing, and certainly not an easy reconstruction for it to be effective, you know, when you're in a small regional hospital in the, you know, us end of the world. They did their best, but it didn't. I had a knee that would collapse for my entire adolescence. It wasn't fixed until I was in my 20s. So I'd have this knee that would just buckle underneath me in regular intervals throughout my adolescence. And so I couldn't play hockey anymore. So my mum said to me, she said, look, you need, why don't you play slow hockey, which was her joke about golf. And it's a good
one. Pretty good burn on golf.
Mum's pretty good. But golf was also easy for my parents because mum was the cleaner at the local golf course and a golf club. Not, she didn't clean the course. It's made of dirt. That's a silly job. No, but she was the cleaner there. So it was sort of my brother and I, we played golf because it was easier for her to keep an eye on us because, you know, mum and dad were kind of involved in the club. But it was a small club and it was $30. I remember this, it was $30 a year for my brother and I to play as juniors. And when I left Smithton, I couldn't play golf anymore because it was so expensive. I had no idea how expensive golf was. And then so I never played again. But the sexism was baked right into the whole idea of golf. Like I couldn't be a member. My brother could be. I was an associate. Women couldn't play on weekends unless we didn't interrupt the men's games. And for a junior girl, like that doesn't leave you much. You've got to go to school. You know, and then like I said, the prizes were a casserole dish. So if I won a big competition, I'd win kitchenware. My brother won a new set of golf clubs. And so it was that sort of thing. And then also there's so many restrictions on what I could or could not wear. When you go away for competition, the skirts were not that I wore skirts, I wore shorts, but they were measured to how high above the knee you had to be. Not that that ever bothered me either, because the longer the better. But basically being ladylike was the driving principle of the team, whereas boys' teams were like, hey, you should try and win. That's probably the most important thing in a game of golf. You should try and win.
It's just the idea of being very competitive about golf to me. I know I don't want to insult everybody who loves golf.
Oh, insulted. I hate it.
But the idea of like really caring who wins at golf, I know it is rife, but it always strikes me as peculiar, like it does for many sports. But okay, your mom pushed you to play any sport, hockey and then slow hockey. Like, what were you into? Did you have sort of your own sort of weird interests?
I was just really just I think back to my childhood and I was just a dreamy kid. I would just live in my own head and I was very happy there. I remember doing things like I would just pick up pegs off the ground and put them in a bucket and then I'd swing and just throw the bucket so the pegs landed every which way and then I'd go around and put the pegs back in the bucket. And I was a bit too old for that to be like a game, but I just really enjoyed the sound of the pegs falling in the bucket. And you know, I look back to all the things that I used to spend a lot of time, and a lot of it revolved around repetition, pleasant sounds and things like that. You know, I used to play with Lego a lot, but I never built elaborate Lego situations because we didn't really have the kits. We just had everyone's leftover Legos. So we just had a drawer full of spare Lego, which is fine. It's good. My brothers could build interesting things, but I would just build walls just balls, because I was just into repetitive tasks. And I think it was because I just liked doing things while I was thinking. And that's probably why I like golf. Because it's like, it's a lot of alone time.
Yeah, I guess that would be right. So I want to say before I ask the next question that for people who haven't seen Douglas, it's very much about autism and your autism diagnosis and what it was like growing up with autism. And since our first like legendary but unreleased conversation, I've been doing a lot more reading on that. And so I don't want to like impose anybody else's experience on you. But one of the things that was really, I guess, somewhere between poignant and really sad to me in some of the in the book I was reading was how much people refuse to believe that kids who are autistic who are enjoying doing something that didn't seem enjoyable to their parents or didn't seem socially like what a child should be doing were having a kind of rich, good experience, and how many kids were institutionalized because they couldn't make that single, like it seems now in retrospect, very obvious leap. That people, you know, some kids like building big walls of Legos and having the repetitive activity, but the effort to like force people away from that just was the driver of all this terrible tragedy and what happened to children. Was it hard for people around you to sort of understand and leave you to what you liked, or was that something that your family was pretty good about?
Well, in many ways, I was very lucky. I was the youngest of a very large family, and so by the time I came along, my parents were exhausted. We weren't very well off. So my parents, you know, they had the, you know, looking after five kids on not so much money. You know, dad delivered the papers in the morning, and then, you know, mum was the cleaner at the country club. They then cooked counter meals because I was trying to support my older brother through university. And then we used to work on farms just to try and make ends meet. So it's like a very busy place. There was no, like, as long as we were polite, you know, then that's my parents believe that's, we have to try our hardest and be polite. And I was kind of raised by my brothers and sisters more, not because my parents were absent, they were very present, but because they were tired and they were wrangling five kids, and they're like, you're now a group, you play together. And so it was very easy for me to understand my place in a ready-made family. And it was very easy for me to disappear when I needed a bit of quiet time. I had my, you know, I'd hide under the hedge and have a sit down and a nap, or I'd hide in the linen press on a bad day. You know, like I just would disappear and take myself out. And I look back and I go, oh, I was resetting. But, you know, there's a difference between boys and girls when it comes, you know, biologically, in autism, in the experience of autism. For some reason, and it's very, very understudied, but girls are better at masking. So when you're doing the wrong thing, you look like you're doing the right thing. Girls often look like they're doing the right thing more often than young boys with autism are able to do. And, you know, I think that's a really interesting area of study, you know, that could be done. It was just like, is that because more expectations are on girls to be more social? So that, you know, often if boys hyper-focus, that's not such a bad thing. The real problem hits for most girls, and this is often why they're misdiagnosed or never diagnosed or diagnosed much later in life, is because it becomes suddenly much more difficult to get away with looking like you're doing the wrong thing as relationships become more complex. So when I was really young, I was fine to a certain extent. People left me alone. I left them alone. I knew how to be polite. But then, you know, once sort of like early teens, relationships become more complex, and particularly in you know, female school relationships. And that's when it all fell apart for me, and it falls apart for many girls, is that age, and suddenly the simplicity of childhood and childhood relationships becomes very, very fraught, and girls with autism cannot navigate them. We're just terrible at them And the problem with that time frame is that it coincides with puberty. And then people go, it's just hormones. And so you get sort of lumped in, you know, I'd have a meltdown. I'd go to school. I'd just struggle all day. I'd do things wrong. People were mean to me. I'd get bullied. I'd come home and that's where you're safe. And you'd let it all go and I'd have meltdowns. And then that was then just like, oh, you're being hormonal. You're a teenage girl. But what was really happening was far more neurobiological as opposed to just being a teen. So my childhood up to a certain age was relatively happy. And then it got deeply traumatic very quickly. And I never recovered.
Tell me a bit about what the experience of school was like. It sounds like it changed over time, but was it school in terms of the learning side of it? You talk a bit about this in Douglas. Was it the social side of it? Was it all of it? What was school like for you?
Well, the pluses of school were routine. The uniform, I love the uniform because we're told what to wear, so there's no choice. I've carried that into adulthood. I only wear blue clothes now because it completely limits choice. And also it's a calming color for me to look at. So if I'm out in the world and I start to feel a little distressed, I always know that there's something blue I can look at, which tends to have a calming effect. Now when I have people who want to dress me for photo shoots, it's a really great boundary that I'm able to set. It's just like, nah, I'm not wearing your fancy clothes. I only wear blue ones. If you can't find me fancy blue ones, I'll wear my own clothes. Okay, bye. It's amazing how much stylists do not want to listen. But anyway, that's another story and just not a world I really feel like I'll ever truly belong to. So the routine and the uniform appealed to me. But where I really struggled was free time. I just never understood what I was supposed to do in lunch and little lunch, as we called it. And the schoolyard politics were near on impossible for me to navigate. I used to walk around looking busy. That's all I did. I knew how to keep my head down. I knew how not to draw attention to myself. So I was never bullied terribly. But in order to avoid being bullied, because I had a taste of it, but it meant that I just wasn't allowed to participate. So I was just completely alone and isolated. And so I was just sort of a ghost almost. And then the older I got, you know, during early years, you know, you have the one teacher who would teach you everything for the whole year. And I like that. And then you get to, I don't know what you call it, where you are. Is it middle school, I guess?
Yeah, that's where everything goes to hell.
Yeah, and I just would have daily nervous breakdowns. This is the wrong word, but they're meltdowns because I couldn't get so many changes. I had every class was different. I don't have executive functions, so being able to handle a timetable and different teachers, and it's not just all those things. For me, it comes out different smells. Like I take time to adjust to new environments, and that includes, you know, visual clutter, smell, sound, all these very basic inputs before you even get to learning. So I was completely overwhelmed. And to put that into context, I went to a tiny school and I went to school with people that I'd known my entire life. And, you know, I lived within a very small town. Like it's not overwhelming on paper, you know, like the town I grew up in, you know, it's 2,000 people. And it wasn't a thoroughfare. It was an end of the road. So we didn't even have tourists who'd interrupted in summer. Like it's not a, you know what I mean? Like it's what some people would call a hole. And certainly not me, but I just did. And so, you know, I like to remind myself that, you know, when I'm struggling now, it's just like, I didn't have any hope of struggling in the world that I live in now. I mean, surviving, you know, I was never going to adapt because I couldn't adapt to a world that was so consistent anyway.
I have an 18-month-old son, and I think a lot about when he starts going to school, because I'm not in any way comparing my experience to yours. I don't think I'm on any on the spectrum, but I had a really hard time in school. I was bullied really badly and did very poorly. And I found school completely illegible, like literally starting in middle school, which is why I said where it all goes to hell. For years, I couldn't figure it out. And like college had picked back up for me. Like end of high school, I started to like get my bearings. But I think a lot about how, and this is why your comment about just the smells and the changes brought this up for me, how we expect school to just be legible to kids. The idea that there'd be intangibles that you might need to like move around, right? That, oh, like now as an adult, like how the room looks to me is important, right? I try to declutter my desk before I start working. There's music I like, music I don't like. The amount of control, I drink caffeine, like the amount of control I try to create in my space to do work well, it's pretty intense. And nobody tells you when you're a kid going to school that like, oh, your environment is going to matter for this. It's not just, are you smart? It's not just, are you paying attention? It's not just, are you being good? And I don't know, like, will I be more sensitive to that as a father? Because I had some of that experience, but it seems like there's a lot we don't tell kids about going to school. And in retrospect, it strikes me as really strange.
Well, because we don't know what it's like to go to school. Honestly, the landscape changes so quickly now. My mum had no idea what my school was like. Because of the generation gap, things are evolving. Like we don't know what it's like to go to school surrounded by technology. We don't understand what that is. So I think the speed in which, you know, society and the world and learning and living changes means that we literally do not understand what school looks and feels like now. So, I mean, you know, it's hard for, like, my mum barely finished school. So it's not like she could tell me what high school was like. She was already, you know, had an apprenticeship to be a hairdresser by the time I was in my second year of high school. So how was she going to help? How is she going to help me navigate high school? You know, like a lot of parents now didn't grow up with you know, smartphones and you know, all those sorts of things as part of the social interaction. So how are they going to help kids navigate that now? Like, I think it comes down to a blindness and a, like, we actually don't understand the landscape that younger people have to navigate. And that's why it's so important. It's not to tell kids how it's going to be, it's to listen to them as they try and find words to tell us how it is for them. And that's sort of the struggle of autism, you know, like, you know, you see parents is like, you've got to go to the, you know, got to go to a birthday party. And a kid with autism is like, I don't want to go to a birthday party. They're hellscapes for me. But parents are going, yes, but in order to be a normal person, you have to love birthday parties. You're sad because you're alone. And kids with autism are like, no, I'm happy because I'm alone. Being alone is happiness to me. I visited a school for kids with autism in Portland when I was on tour, and one of the most just beautiful sights I ever saw, and it made me grieve for my own childhood in a way, was we pulled up and it was lunchtime, and there was just a schoolyard full, and it was quiet, just a schoolyard full of kids on their own doing their own thing. And it was just beautiful, because it's like, these are the kids that would stand on their own because people go, oh, they're being bullied and ostracized. But what's happening at that school is like, they want to be on their own. Like, and they, you know, there's a difference between feeling safe to approach people when and if you need to, and then also then on the other hand, just being forced to always interact is really distressing.
What is the experience of what was the experience of a kid's birthday party like for you?
I always made friends with their mums. They made more sense. And I didn't go. I say that, like, I went to about two or three, and one was a slumber party, and that was my last. I couldn't cope with that. Just sleeping with the smell of another person's house. No, thank you. When I was a kid, I'm okay now. I bring my own smells with. That's not as rank as it sounds. Anyways, you know, it's fine because it's just the noise and as I got older, the politics of social engagements. But when you're really little, it's fine. They're like, because adults are supervising. And I go, now we're going to play this game. And then there's always treats. So it always felt okay, but it was always overwhelming. I used to get really tired. But there weren't actually that many birthday parties.
Were there subjects you loved in school?
I loved everything when I was younger, like when I'm, you know, in the first 4 or 5 years of school, and then I hated everything. I just got overwhelmed because I didn't know how to learn. I wonder how different it'd be for me now, having access to the internet. Honestly, the internet has allowed me to foster my creativity and my curiosity, and I wouldn't have said I was creative or curious when I was at school. I just honestly didn't seem to exhibit either of those things. And a lot of that's environment. Like I was at a school that, you know, anyone with money or means or that sort of stuff, they went to school elsewhere. So really it was a fairly rough school I went to. It was a good school, like for what it was. And so I'm not saying I went to a terrible school, but it was not a school where people struggling to learn had any help, especially someone like myself who's smart. So I get by, but I was struggling. Like I wasn't living, you know, I wasn't learning to the fullest of my potential, but 40% of my potential was a good student at my school. So I could get by, and that's what I learned to do, just get by. And just getting by is not the same as learning. I learned how to just do enough to pass. I couldn't write essays. I couldn't finish. I can't do a lot of things still. I have help now. I have help. You know, if I have to write things that have to be handed in, I know now that I'm allowed to have help and ask for help. But for many years, I didn't understand that I had a learning difficulty. And I just struggled under the weight of things. The last year of school, my family moved from Smithton, and so I went to a place called Launceston, which is in the north of Tasmania. It's the second biggest city. It's not very big at all, but it was so big to me, and I just ceased to function. I'd have panic attacks, meltdowns, usually on my own because I was invisible suddenly. My parents were stressed for their own reasons. My brothers and sisters had all left home, and I was trying to navigate a brand new environment, and I couldn't. And I all but failed. The only reason I didn't fail school was I knew enough to get a doctor's certificate. And I remember going to there, I can't do these things. I'm really tired. And I was really tired, but I got diagnosed with a virus. If the doctor had asked any questions, I should have got a diagnosis of severe depression and anxiety. But I didn't even know those things existed, so I didn't know how to angle my answers and, you know, have words around those things. If the doctor had known even more, I should have been diagnosed with autism. But what I had was a virus that allowed me not to fail, just pass this kid. She's obviously smart. She's not well. We don't want to invest time in re-educating her. Let's just push her through. It was just incredibly easy for someone like me to fall through the cracks. Nobody cared, least of all me. So I finished school, and it's important to know I didn't learn anything. Like I was way behind. Like I didn't know how to do things that kids should know how to do. But I was, you know, smart-ish. But, I barely spoke. I had no confidence. My first job out of school was I got a job at a supermarket. And I honestly thought that was good. That was where I was going to go. Like, that's my job. I'm going to work in a supermarket. And, you know, I'm smart, so I should be able to work my way up through the ranks of the supermarket. And that's wrong. I wasn't good enough to work in a supermarket. And I look at what, you know, now in this point in history, people who work in supermarkets, nah, I did not have what it takes to work at a supermarket. They are in it. People working in grocery stores at the moment, that's a tough job. And I don't have what it takes to work at a grocery store. And I knew it then. I was put in the delicatessen because they didn't want me at the front of the shop. Because I was monosyllabic. I think it's really important to stress that. Like, I was monosyllabic. Like, if I could talk, I used the least words as possible. And, you know, I was much less capable of faking eye contact back then. So I'd be looking at the ground and mumbling, and I needed to be told what to do every step of the way. I lacked initiative, right? I could have been an incredible worker if someone every step of the way going, this is what you need to do, this is when you need to do it. But I didn't sort of get taught that. So I was really, really struggling. And then I slipped on chicken fat. It's just a funny thing to say. And then
I'm sure this was terrible. That was just a funny.
It's so funny. My life is full of this. It's like, and then a weird accident happened. And that's what it was. Like, it was a really, really bad accident. And I again had to have a total knee reconstruction. So, like, within 3 weeks of my first ever job, and I'm like, this is me. This is I'm being an adult. I'm going to make it. I'd had a total knee reconstruction again, and I had to go and, you know, really massive surgery and rehabilitation. And that was really difficult to navigate. Yeah, I was still living at home, but my mum thought it was time I wasn't living at home, and her way of letting me know that was not giving me any support. And so I was trying to, you know, navigate these things. While not being able to walk, and I didn't have any friends. I didn't know how to make friends, and I couldn't walk. And then from that, I did a season of farm work, and then because it was just a season, you know, it's seasonal. And then I got a job selling knives. And when I say a job, I mean I entered a borderline pyramid scheme and failed badly. Yeah. And then I just, adding to that was a certain amount of trauma, and the thing about trauma is you cannot imagine a future. Like, you cannot project yourself into a future, positive or otherwise. You're trapped. You're trapped. So I was trapped physically, financially, literally, and also figuratively.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise might just be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, sending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account could work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, WISE.com, Wise.com.
Support for the Gray Area comes from Burrow. Getting the right furniture for your place can be really annoying. At this point in my life, I've probably gone through maybe 3 sets of outdoor deck furniture, and it's a pain in the ass for a different reason every single time. It doesn't look like it did in the pictures, the assembly isn't what they said it was, or it's just not as advertised for whatever reason. Thankfully, Burrow is the furniture company that wants to make it all a little easier. Last year, Burrow introduced their outdoor line, and this spring they're adding to it with their Dunes line, offering new seating, dining, and lounger options designed for luxury, comfort, and durability. Burrow furniture is easy to put together and take apart, so you can move or store it as needed. And it ships straight to your door for free. Gray Area listeners can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/box. That's Burrow, BURROW.com/box for 15% off. Burrow.com/box.
If you only know you from your specials, one of the things that I know about you from that is that you went to college and you got an art history degree, and you seem to have kept more of that than certainly I kept anything of from college. So what was it that made some of the learning click or stick? What is the line between the part of it that held for you and the parts of it that didn't?
It was art, like looking at pictures. Pictures open up a world for me, and a way to learn about the world that words and speech didn't. It sort of seemed to trigger an expansive thinking that nothing else kind of did for me. I could travel, my mind could travel and take wonderful turns. And I was introduced to art when I was in my little school in Smithton, and there was a few art history books, and it makes me laugh now. They were just full of black and white images. So I learned about art through black and white images, but still, it's like, let me tell you about a Picasso. I've only seen black and white ones, but I can still talk about it. And what was, it's sort of the same way as you do a cryptic crossword. So the best way to do a cryptic crossword is you cheat, right? You look at the answer and then at the clue and try and work out how the clue gets formed. And then you start to learn the language. And so that's kind of how I started to build the world. Like, I'd look at the art and then look at what people said about the art, and then looked at what other people said about the art, and then look at about the context of that art was created. And every time I still had that object and that world to keep going back to, you know, that was full of color and you know, dynamic worlds, but not overwhelming worlds where there was also sound and smell and all these other things. Like, just focusing on one sense, which was in most cases it was visual. So it both expanded and limited, you know, the touchstones. So where I was from, being interested in art meant nothing. There was no galleries. There was no, you know, there was no art world. There was no first rung of the art world ladder where I was from. Like, it didn't seem like, it was just the joy of it. And so I was always obsessed with art. I was always thinking and looking at art. But, of course, I didn't have access to the internet. So it wasn't like I could go online like I do now and just go on these rabbit hole journeys and go, you know, just have the best time, you know, tracing ideas around. I was stuck with libraries, and libraries are not places I tend to think well in, because it's something about the temperature of books puts me to, you know, we don't flourish in the same temperature, books and I. So libraries tend to make me go to sleep, and the fluorescent lights make me slightly ill. So, you know, I'd take books out of the library, and then I could go home, and, you know, and even when I was sort of, you know, left school, I would go to the public library and do that. I also have an affinity with indexes. I love going through the indexes. You learn what's important in the book before you have to go into the book. And it's sort of that makes me see that I the way that I make sense of the world is different to everybody, you know, to most people. I have to work my way backwards to make sense of things. But doing that, what I've discovered later in life is that I get different things because of the way that I think and the way that I learn means that I have different perspectives and a different way of seeing the world that I don't think is, I always used to think it was a deficiency, but now I see that it's
a strength.
Yeah. Yeah, but a strength, and I always think of the strengths in terms of outside of me. You know, inside of me when I'm just on my own, it's just how I do things. And I like it and I love it and I don't feel the need to justify it to anybody else. Right. But as soon as I start being in the world and trying to communicate, it was always a deficiency. It was an embarrassing thing, you know, that I had to do these things and I was so slow. And now I see it as a strength, but it was always a wonderful place for me when I'm on my own.
So then how does somebody who is monosyllabic, tries to speak in as few words as possible, doesn't like big groups of people, move to stand-up comedy?
Well, there's a large chunk of my life missing between where I left off and when I started doing comedy, and that was, you know, going to college. And that came about because I was just running out of, like, life options. I couldn't even hold down a job at a supermarket. I failed at trying to be an adult for long enough that I became what's known here as a mature age student, which meant you could pretty much get into university.
How old were you when you went to university?
21. So it's not very old, but they make you feel like, well, you're an adult now and you failed at being an adult, so here's a mature age student slot.
21.
Which is so funny to me. So naive and immature on so many levels because I'd never participated in life. I'd never actively been involved in life. I just lived inside of my head. And whenever I was outside of my head, I was just coping. So I moved to Hobart, which is the first time I lived outside of home. And it was an unmitigated disaster. I failed again. But again, because I'd learned the trick of getting I used to think I was cheating. It's like, oh, if I get a doctor's certificate, it's fine. But what I realized in hindsight, I was like, no, I needed help and I didn't get it. And I didn't know how to ask for it. And I was depressed and, you know, a really, really horrible anxiety. Like I could not function. And that's when I started drinking quite heavily because, and smoking, because I guess, and I'm not guessing, it is like basically numbing the input. So in a sense, because I'm so sensitive to my environment, noise, sound, smell, noise is sound, but sound, I feel sound. So sound becomes a feeling quite strongly in my body. And that works both ways, but I've only just discovered the pleasant feeling sounds and how to skew my environment so that things feel pleasant to hear. But for the most part, pain. I feel a lot of pain with certain sounds. And add to that a lack of executive function. And that's when I was beaten up. So that was such a low. Like I can't even, I just feel such sadness for that, Hannah, because it's like so alone. And then trying to understand my sexuality, I knew I was gay, but also I knew like homosexuality was only legalized in 1997. And that's when I was 19. So I was living, not being able to hold a job down at a supermarket then. And just because the law had changed didn't mean it was necessarily a safe place to be gay. And certainly I found that out when I was in Hobart, my first year of university. And that, so like, it's interesting to me because people do only know me from the net. And I'm talking about that time of my life. But I think people take me and think that I was the person I was when I stood up on stage as the same person I was when all that happened to me. But I wasn't. Like, I was a husk. I was a shell. I was so full of anxiety and an inability to navigate the world. I was alone. I didn't really have friends. I started to make friends at university, but I didn't understand how to maintain those friendships. I couldn't pay bills. And what's really fascinating to me in that is like that's the year Ellen came out. And It just blows my mind. Now, Ellen's quite in the news at the moment, and people are starting to ask me, what do I think about that? And I can't help but think of the context, my own context in all that. And it's just like, you know, when Ellen came out, it didn't mean a thing to me. Like, it had absolutely no impact into my, because that's where I was. I was a nothing person. Like, I didn't even identify as being gay. I was subhuman. And so after I got beaten up, I just sort of decided to apply for every single university on the mainland as I possibly could, mainland being the rest of Australia. And I couldn't do that because that involved an enormous amount of executive function that I just simply don't have. So basically what I was able to do is find universities that taught art history because I knew that was something I was at least interested in. And there's very few of those in Australia. So I just applied to all of them and I managed to get into one. And then I left Tasmania.
And so what happens at university that begins to bridge the gap between the person who can stand on the stage and the person who is a husk?
It was a very slow recovery. Going to the mainland helped enormously. Like, Tasmania had become very, very claustrophobic for me in many ways. Like, I had to learn the basics of life. I had to learn how to look after myself. I had to learn how to pay bills. And I struggled, like, doing those normal things still to this very day are things that I actually really, really struggle to do. One of the things that happened at university, which sort of throws this, like, are you kidding me? Like, if this, are you kidding me now? Are you just making this up now? But I got hit by 3 cars while I was at university.
That's all at once or just one, just every couple of weeks? Or how did you space them out?
Well, so the first one, it was my first 6 months of being there, now that I say it out loud, it's going to sound ridiculous, but it was a hit and miss. A miss and hit. So basically a car just went too close to me and I had to swerve and I hit a parked car. But I broke my ankle.
A miss and hit is a hilarious way to describe that.
Thank you. So I hit a parked car, but after being sort of, you know, drivers in Australia hate cyclists. And the way they show that is by driving dangerously. The better the roads, the worse the drivers. That's a good rule of thumb. I've learnt this. Anyway, so I had it was a bit of a dust up, but just a broken ankle. That's fine. And then the next one is someone reversed. I kept riding my bike, and this is an important distinction to make. I kept getting hit by cars, and I kept getting back on my bike. And the reason for that is that I couldn't afford to drive, because in order to drive, you have to get driving lessons and a car, and those two things were just not anything that I was capable of scrambling together. And the alternative to that is public transport. And I cannot read bus timetables. I cannot cope with the environment on public transport. Like, it's just really distressing. Public transport is really distressing for me. So the option for me was to cycle. And I love riding my bike. I love moving through space. So I really love that. I did not love getting hit. And so the second one is a man just reversed out of his driveway too quickly and I was riding past and he collected me. And I cracked ribs and bruised my liver on that one. And what was really strange about that one is I was really, really badly hurt. But he sued me, or he asked, I don't know that he sued me. He just asked for money and then I disappeared. I don't know what happened. But he wanted me to pay for his boot. Like, you call it a trunk. Like, I dented his trunk and he wanted, like, me to pay for that. So I gave him a down payment on it. I didn't have any money. Like, what a bully. Like, what a bully. He hits a kid on a bike.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah, but because I didn't understand how the world worked, people could bully me and people did like people would take advantage of me all the time. Anyway, so that was that. And so I kept falling behind at university, naturally. And then the last one was, and this all happened within a year of the third time I got hit was actually really bad. I got doored. So I was cycling and then someone opened their car door and collected me and I shattered my collarbone. You know, so there was no one looking out for me at that stage. I mean, they could have been had I asked for it, but no one was because I didn't know how to ask for it because I didn't think I was worth it. So I had this broken bone and it should have been fixed surgically because it's so far displaced. But the doc, you know, I don't know, maybe I was uninteresting to the people in an emergency or something, but they've just gone, yeah, it'll be right. And it wasn't right. And then down the track, I had to have it repaired. So this was all, in Australia, we have healthcare. So I was looked after in that sense. And because it was a road accident, there's a certain amount of protection you get around road accidents. People have insurance for that. So, and it's compulsory insurance. So these, the at least at this stage, my healthcare was being paid for because it was an accident that wasn't my fault. But I had a pin put in my shoulder and then the pin didn't work. The pin ended up working itself loose and coming out the back of my shoulder. It removed itself from the clavicle and came out. And the doctor who put it in, he told me that I shouldn't sue. And I believed him. And I'm like, oh, my God, you're the last person who should be giving me that advice. But I was so green. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, yeah, because, you know, you're the lucky one. It happened to two other people in the US and it went and it punctured their lungs. So the pin went the other way. And so you got this whole sort of like, I was just not the person to be able to fight this medical insurance thing because, you know, now you know, like, you know, medical companies that make these things and, you know, what is the, you know, it's a minefield. I know now as an adult who can look at these things, it's like there was never any hope for someone like me to be able to fight for my rights there. That it's like this pin shouldn't have been in circulation, shouldn't never be put into a human body. But I'm exhausted. I'm on my own, you know, and the doctor who put it in there said it's useless to fight this. So there it was. So that's what I was actually doing at university, is I had four more operations on that shoulder and continued to sort of just do the bare minimum to pass. And then I graduated and fell off the face of the earth again.
And how do you end up on a stage?
Well, that's the mystery. I started working. I was working in a bookshop and as a cinema projectionist, film projectionist. I had a skill, but I couldn't make enough money off those. I didn't know how to graduate from entry level casual positions. I didn't know how to like, oh, you've been working in a bookshop for 4 years. Would you like to manage the weekend shifts? Those things were never going to happen to me. I was just bad at life and bad at work. You know, lacking initiative is like is really hard to make it. So I then got a job as a farm laborer and was traveling around the country, you know, harvesting broccoli, planting trees. And that's an industry that really exploits workers. So basically I was working, you know, 16-hour days and not earning enough to pay rent. So I was living in a tent.
So you were homeless.
Yeah, I was homeless and in a cycle that I didn't know how to break out of. Like I didn't know because I was also traumatized. I didn't know how to imagine a better future and I didn't think I deserved one. I look back and I'm like, if I hadn't found stand-up comedy, I would be dead by now. I just really honestly believe that. The fact that I found my way out of it is a story of such rich absurdity that it almost doesn't ring true. You know, it's like the rags to riches story that is just so ridiculous that I'm almost embarrassed. Like I just go, people just won't believe me. But there it is. I've moved past what other people think. It's like, I just don't know how else to explain it. So what ended up happening is I had another accident. A piece of farm machinery kicked back and it basically tore all the ligaments in my hand, which meant that I just had this, there's no stability. And I had to, I got screwed around with workers' comp, I'm sure. Like, I look back on that and going, I was a very vulnerable citizen and nobody really looked after me and I didn't know how to ask for it. Anyway, so I had to have my wrist fused. I've had all the bone taken out of my hip and put into my wrist, and I've got plate and screws all through there. So that's what's holding that together. And during that process, I got to go to hospital, which was which sounds really silly, but it's just like, I remember going to hospital going, I've been living in a tent. And that was the point at which I got back in contact with my family. Like, I'd come out during at university and it didn't go well. And I didn't have the strength to wrangle that emotion. And so I just let myself drift away from my family. They didn't ostracize me. I just didn't know how to navigate it. So I let go and drifted. As soon as I got back in contact with my sister, I went to live with my sister. And then after that, I moved to Melbourne and I lived with my brother. And that was up until really, really recently. I was relying on my family to get me out of the financial desert. And I was I was homeless. And if it wasn't for my family, I would never have been able to pursue comedy, because it was the generosity of them that allowed me to do something, to be able to pursue comedy. And the reason I got into that was after I'd had my surgery is I entered a competition and there was no reason for me to do it. I still don't understand why I did it, but I did it. I entered a national competition here. It's called Raw Comedy. It's run through the Melbourne Comedy Festival. And they just basically travel the country and try and find, interesting new voices. And I signed up for it and I did all right. I got into the state finals and I didn't get any further than that. But then the next year I won. I entered it the year after and I won the national competition, which was televised. And it's no small thing, but I understood how to navigate the stage better than I ever understood how to navigate a normal room, a normal social interaction. As soon as I stood on stage, I somehow knew how to cajole the energy in the room. I felt like a conductor. I knew people had a response to me and I knew how to wrangle that response to me. The strangeness of my presence made people take notice of me, and then once I had that notice, I knew what to do with it. And I'm certainly I wasn't as good as I am now when I first started, but I had, I guess that's what they call a natural ability. So every opportunity I got, I made the most of. And when I first started doing comedy, I was monosyllabic. My first joke was, and I'd deliver it like this, go, "Hi, my name's Hannah. That's a palindrome. It's a word you can spell the same way, forwards and backwards, if you can spell. It's a family tradition. Everyone in my family has palindromic names. We've got mum, dad, nan, pop, and my brother Kayak." Now, and it's a really great joke, but that's how I deliver it. I've learned how to put inflection in my voice. I've learned these things, but even the bare bones of it, I understood how to make jokes and then how to be a presence on stage. And there's no evidence that that was going to be the case. There's nothing in my life that would have said, "Oh, this one's a natural performer."
In Nanette, you define telling jokes is sort of building this tension in the audience and then releasing it. Do you think part of it is simply that as somebody who found conversations less legible, that you were just comfortable with the tension? So when it came time to inflict it upon others, that was a more natural space for you?
Well, but yes, I couldn't navigate in this tension in that, but also I'm a tension. My actual presence has always caused tension. I've never done things right. It's less so because I've learned more as I've gotten older. I'm a late bloomer. But when I was a kid, I didn't do things right. And when you don't do things right, you cause tension. So I learned how to diffuse that tension that I myself created. And I always used to think it was just the fact that I was, you know, a butch woman that caused the tension. But now I understand it's also how I interact with the world, courtesy of my neurobiological situation, that also causes the tension. So that natural ability that I had as soon as I walked on stage was really grafted through a life of being a presence that was off-putting to people.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Greenlight. If you're a parent of teenagers, you might be starting conversations about money management and financial literacy. So often, the best way to learn is to do. But when it comes to money, there can be real consequences to learning the hard way. That's where Greenlight comes in. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their spending and saving. And kids and teens can build money confidence and lifelong financial skills. My kid is way too young to talk money with, thank God. But I have a colleague here at Vox that uses Greenlight with his boys, and he loves it. If you want to help your kids learn about money, consider Greenlight. It's a convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and for families to navigate this stuff together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/grayarea. That's greenlight.com/grayarea to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/grayarea.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
I want to take a slight turn here into a tenser or yet tenser space that I was thinking about rewatching Nanette getting ready for this conversation. So in journalism, political journalism, there's been this ongoing set of fights about speech and safety. And I think on some level, tension. And something you say in Nanette at the end, as you begin giving your story more honestly, you say that you're not going to do the thing here of releasing the tension of what your life has really been like, that tension is now ours, the audience's, to hold. And that should give us some idea of the tension people on the margins hold all the time. And I wanted to ask about that experience, because I do think part of what is happening in my industry is people are very uncomfortable with the amount of tension and they want it to stop. And that people who have been under tension don't. They want that to be shared. What is it like to be under tension all the time? What lessons does it teach? What do you take from it?
It's not a great place to be in. And it's called stress. And humans don't operate the best when they're stressed and distressed. But when you're on the margins, that's a constant. And I've only just recently left that space. I've suddenly found myself in a position, just as the world is devolving into chaos and uncertainty, I've suddenly found out that I'm not distressed all the time anymore. And I didn't understand that that's how I was living. I'm really new to this. And I find myself in this strange world where, people would look at me and go, oh, you're privileged, and I am, but I don't have years of training to be in this position. I have much more experience in being invisible and unheard and living in deep distress and stress than I do privilege. I know what it's like to feel tension and to have everything, like I said it about how I live my life, like I didn't live it. I coped. I tried not to draw attention to myself. I live with, you know, pulling my head in. And when you do that, you don't get to live. You don't get to talk. You don't get to breathe. Like I really understand that sentiment of the Black Lives Matter. You know, I can't breathe, like for very, very, very different reasons. But I understand that feeling of not being able to breathe. And it is not, it is inhumane to keep people in that state. And when people tell you that they can't breathe, it takes an enormous amount of pain and strength to be able to not just say it out loud, but to understand that that is what is happening to you. Like, I didn't understand how terrible my life was, because that's what being on the margins does to you. It tells you that being treated inhumanely is all you deserve, and that's the reality of it. I saw that letter and you know what? Like, I don't care. Like, what that is talking about is not actually, it's not a fight for survival. And you know what? Like, if there's a mob on Twitter, like, it's the problem with the debate is toxic because only the worst voices are amplified. There's no, like, it just is this binary of, you know, and I just get exhausted by that. And I, you know, to a certain extent, I grew up with that, like, the debate around human rights with, you know, the legalization of homosexuality in Tasmania. All you ever heard were the extremes of those arguments. And what was missing from that were people just caring. I just think in this moment in time, people can't pay their rent. People are literally and metaphorically struggling to even breathe. And it's like, if you've got a platform, then just use that platform to talk about things and draw attention to people who don't have a voice, or move aside and give a platform to people who need a voice. Like, I just, this is the elite complaining. That's what that says to me. Like, I read that, like, I understand it's all intellectual and fun intellectual games, but like, freedom of speech is in trouble. But that letter just seems like a waste of energy to me. Like, I just was bored by it. I'm just like, are you kidding me? This is what you're going to waste your time on? Like, I understand it's really important. Freedom of speech is the big, but you've got freedom of speech. Use it. Not to complain about how you feel a little scared to say your peace of mind. Like, apart from that, what are you using your freedom of speech for then? What are you using it for? What are you using your platform for? Like, if you're just using your platform, your enormous platform, to talk about freedom of speech, then you are wasting your time. Use your freedom of speech constructively to actually build something, to help others use theirs.
One of the things that strikes me as maybe similar between the comedy world and some of the debates that have happened there in the past couple of years and the journalism world is that it feels to me like if you have these big platforms now, it stopped being enough to just have opinions because there's so much more conversation in different directions. The audience can speak to you. Like, everything is taped. It goes up on YouTube. There are conversations around your conversations. And so now you have to, if you want to take on these hard issues, you have to have all these other skills of managing a hard conversation, of dealing with feedback and criticism well, of all these things a lot of us weren't taught. And I feel like I'm seeing something sort of similar to what I've seen in, or what I think I've seen in comedy, where as the audience began to be able to speak back, there's been a lot of anger and a lot of fear. There is some fear, right? People are worried about being canceled or fired. I don't want to take away that there is, that there can be real concern here. But it does seem to me that just part of it is, yeah, it's just going to mean that if you have this big platform, you're going to have to learn how to do more than have views. And that's harder. Like it is definitely harder. Like I feel it too. Like it is harder, but I think it's going to be what it looks like from here on out.
I don't have a problem with taking responsibility for your speech. Like, you know, the cancel culture only happens in this area. Like in other places, it's just called taking responsibility for your actions. I mean, I just don't come from media entertainment background. Like I had to work with dangerous men for a long time. Like I had to work alongside of men who are trapped in the cycle of poverty and drug abuse. And we were working on farms together. And I was frightened of those men. And I had no voice. You know, like I was unsafe in their company. But I'm not vulnerable like they are now. Like, and that's a very interesting space for me to occupy. Like all of a sudden I have a huge platform. I have a huge, you know, like sphere of influence. Those guys who were, could have, like, you know, they posed a real, like it was dangerous to be in their midst, right? For me. But their life still sucks. Like, I don't know how to navigate that, but I just, like, that's the world I'm from. Like, if there's a fight about freedom of speech, it was a literal fight with punches thrown. Like, it's a rough place. And so, you know, sometimes comedians are so sensitive about criticism. It's weird to me. Like, and then their fans get even more sensitive on their behalf, and as a bit of you know, and I just keep going back to, like, this is just silliness. Like, this is immature use of time. Like, I'm very confused about the moment, what people are angry about. I honestly don't understand what a lot of people are angry about. I do understand that they're angry and I care that they are, but I don't know what they're angry about.
I think one of the things I hear that I heard for a long time in comedy, and I'm starting to hear from a more part of the journalism world, is this idea that the audience through Twitter and social media, not the audience, but like a very, like a portion of the audience, like the loud voices in the audience, that because of their ability to create crowd dynamics, that it's creating boundaries on what people can say, and that the comedians feel that they were there to have hard conversations and talk about things that, you know, are tricky to talk about, and now they feel they can't, and they're watching their backs and can't work out material. And you get that sort of in the political world too.
Yeah, look, in comedy, like, it's just bringing the reality of what it always should have been, and that is a dialogue with your audience. Like, if you stand up in front of a crowd, you're not talking at them. And I think a lot of comedians think that that's their right. They get up and say, they get to talk at a group of people. But a crowd is a living, breathing thing. And in the room, that's what it used to be. That crowd was just in the room and you had a dialogue with that room. But now it's got to the point where that room has now expanded, right? It's not just the room that you're in. And so there's a huge, like, you've just got to be more careful and more, you know, if you're going to say something, then you better believe it. And that's just responsible speech. Like, if you believe something, then you should be all right. Like, if you're holding your, but a lot of comedy, particularly when I was coming up through the ranks, what was in vogue was shock comedy. So the laugh came from being shocking. And shock comics are probably struggling in this moment because what they believed in was the right to shock, not what they were saying. And so I think this has become a really difficult time for them because they're like, it's my right to shock. I'm like, well, what are you saying? So, you know, like it's just, I think it's, you've got to really believe in what you're saying now, and you've got to be careful on how you phrase that. And mistakes are going to be made because language is messy, but I honestly believe we shouldn't be recording everything. Like, that's where the real trouble comes. What I said in the very beginning is it's like permanent records of communication is really it's a really difficult space to navigate because communication needs to be able to be flexible and dynamic and adaptive. But because we have these permanent records now, this is like, you need to get what you got to say out best. Like you either have to be just really, really, really on point every single time you say anything, or you just be completely bland. And that is a boring world to live in, a boring world of extremes. And so I think what has to happen, and it probably won't happen anytime soon, is that we need to learn a language of adaptation, evolution, forgiveness, shame, learning how, you know, to shame without the permanence of that shaming. Like you go, hey, you messed up there. How do we then move on from that? Like people are very, you have to be defensive or you have to apologize. There's no nuance to the discussion. And this is an incredibly difficult space for me to navigate because this is a really hyper connected and hyper social world. And I'm really bad at being social. Like I'm really, like my autism means that I'm quite blunt and I fail to pick up on all the nuances. So this is a really difficult space for me personally to navigate. So I don't feel sad when a comedian who used to shock anytime he likes suddenly finds it a difficult space. I'm like, it's always been a difficult space. The world has always been a difficult space.
I want to underline what you were saying about the capacity to have people make mistakes and feel shame and move on. I do think a big part of the problem is a lack of clarity in what that process should look like. Often because there's not real accountability, but there's social accountability. Nothing happens to most people who misstep, but also the feeling of something happening to you is like 25,000 people turn on you online is, it's a kind of trauma to people that sounds weird when they say it. So it doesn't, they don't know what to do with it. But at the same time, the part of it that I've become, I don't want to say unsympathetic to, I agree with what you're saying about it's hard for everything to be recorded. But in my industry, a lot of these problems are just coming from everybody moved onto Twitter. And for years in journalism, we knew that if you wanted to be in a hard conversation talking about tricky issues, we would have this big edifice to protect you, editors and copy editors and people who would check your headline and all these things so that if you like ended up in a bad place, at least your institution was there with you and it tried to help and was now bought in alongside you. And everybody just works out the material on Twitter with none of that around them. And then things go bad. And I think a lot of the tension in my industry just comes from the constant feeling of that.
Yeah, well, why are you working your stuff out on Twitter? Like, why? Who does that? Why
you
shouldn't
work it out on Twitter? It's the worst. Everybody, and I've done it too. I want to say that, like, I have done this. I've stopped tweeting except for tweeting out my articles, just because I've decided that like it's time for me to stop saying I don't like it and act like I don't like it. But it's become a place that a lot of journalists work out the material. Then they work it out poorly, and there's a bad reaction, and just everybody's like anger, like long term, just keeps going up at each other.
Yeah, well, journalists should be better at learning. Like, what's wrong with journalists?
That's true.
Like, I mean, I'm not a journalist, but I don't like. Also, I think that if you have a large platform outside of Twitter, you should get off. Like, you should just like it. Really, could be a space where people who don't have a voice get to have a voice. But if people with huge followings are then just, you know, you just, it's a bullying pulpit.
That's a great term for it.
I really enjoy Twitter for finding voices that I would never, like all social media, like it's a great place to witness. Like, interesting voices saying interesting things. But then if you then have people who already have a massive platform outside of, you know, those things, then, you know, then it becomes... there's a toxicity to it. There's a certain amount of joy I think people get from jumping on a bullying bandwagon, you know? Like, do you know when you don't like something and you think the whole world loves something and then you find out two or three people don't like it and then you're like, oh, this is great, and then all of a sudden there's a tipping point where you're like, oh, no, this is now bullying. It turns out everybody felt the way that I did, but nobody was acknowledging it. That happens a lot on Twitter, and I just don't know where how to find that break where people just go, hey, now this has turned. Like, all of a sudden, like, I just don't think we understand how to see when, like, where's the line where someone who has a lot of power and needs to be held accountable says something awful. There's a line, right, where and a tipping point where it becomes just toxic. But that means you can't, like, there must be a point at which it's helpful for the person to know that they've been a fool. Yeah, have been harmful with their speech or something like that. But then, like, at what point? It needs to be drawn to attention, you know, like, hey, you are saying you're being careless with your words. You're being careless with your ideas. You're not thinking about this perspective, right? I don't know. I just think there's an oxygen that goes into it and it just explodes and nobody's listening and everyone's being angry. And then it's just like, well, this is silliness in a biscuit. But I withdraw. Like, I, you know, even if there's an argument in a room, I'm like, oh, this is not where I want to be.
And then you get, I get, try not to, but you get defensive, right? If it feels like everybody's ganging up on you and it's getting unfair. You talk in Annette, I think, in a really interesting way about feedback, right? People coming up to you after a show and you're like, that's the wrong moment to come up to me. And there is an interesting thing here. I don't want to say that people have a responsibility to give feedback well, but there's both a responsibility on the part of people with a platform to be able to hear criticism without being overwhelmed by it, which I think is a hard thing, right? To hear criticism without being cowed by it, because none of us like being criticized and not getting too defensive so we can't hear it. And then also, I think there's some question, at least if you're somebody who wants to actually be delivering criticism, not just throwing lightning bolts, you know, there are ways to deliver it that people can hear it. And maybe it's, you know, maybe there's a bit of an ask of audiences on this too.
I think defensiveness is normal. It's what you do after that. Like, so what I do after I created two shows, which are pretty much a crafted response that then therefore becomes entertaining for a lot of people to talk about it. Like, I don't feel the need to go back to every person who makes me feel defensive and go, hey, that's unfair. It's just, that's exhausting. Also, people project themselves and what they think you should be. Like, I disappoint so many people because they think I speak for them and I don't, and I can't, and I don't understand why they think that I could. You know, so there are people in the feminist community who don't like what I say, and there are people in the trans community who don't like what I say, and there are a lot of men who don't like what I say, and there's, like, a lot of people don't like what I have to say. But I'm still okay. I'm all right. Because I think it ultimately boils down, like, I believe in what I'm saying. I believe what I'm saying. And I believe that my reason to speak is not to cause harm. My reason speaking is, you know, I want to disrupt people's thinking in order to, you know, get them to have a different way of thinking about things they already think about. I'm not in the business of changing people's minds. I'm in the business of changing how people make their minds. You know, I don't have the end point. I don't have the solution in mind. Like, I don't want to go, this is how you should think. But I really do want to, you know, I like to shake up the room so people think about how they think. And that, because that's the reality of autism. Like you have autism, you have to think about how you think. That's what you do. And neurotypicals don't do that. They just assume the way they think is right. The way that you think, not the end point, not what you think, but how you think. So like when I get, you know, pulled up about the specifics of what I say and things like that, like I listen, I think it's interesting. But ultimately what I'm in the business of is to demand people be more aware of how and why they think, not what they think.
I think that's a lovely place to come to a close. So let me ask you what's always a final question here, which is, what are three books, or having done this with you before, audiobooks, that you, or paintings for that matter, that you would recommend to the audience that you've loved?
I like Louise Bourgeois, Saint Sebastian as a Woman. That is a piece of art I would like people to know about. And they can just go Google that and go on their own adventure.
Saint Sebastian was a Woman is a great recommendation. Not that I would know, but I'm excited to go look it up myself.
Yeah, you should. Also, it's an evolving piece. So she did many, it's something she revisited and it evolved. And the story of the evolution of the piece is really fascinating also. I love The Hidden Life of Trees. It's an audiobook I listen to all the time. I like trees a lot. Trees are pretty cool situations. And you know what I'm listening to on a lot, and it's a really weird one, and I'm just going to put it out there, not as a recommendation as a book, although I'm sure it's pretty great, but it's the book that puts me to sleep and makes me feel calm. And I think this speaks the most to the idiosyncrasy of my neurobiology. It's a book about Putin. It's a biography of Vladimir Putin.
Really?
Yep. When I'm feeling distressed, I put the book about Putin on and I don't listen to it. There's something about it, and I guess, you know, I listened to it once and paid attention to it, and, you know, but then now it's just become a book that, I don't know, it must be, it's very bizarre. Like, he's the worst, right? He's not a good guy. And his story's not good, and his abuse of power is not great. It's The New Tsar by Stephen Lee Myers, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. That's how you know that I'm not typical of the neuro variety.
Hannah Gadsby, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Hannah Gadsby for being here, to Roger Karma for researching, Jeffrey Geld for producing. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production.
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and everyday people about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.